South Florida's urgent HIV battle faces defunding. So does a Miami crime prevention program. Meanwhile, Palm Beach County pays bigly for President Trump's security. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll discuss the HIV infection crisis in South Florida and the serious cuts in federal funding for detection and prevention that could make it worse. We'll also take a look at the $250,000 per day cost of protecting President Trump that Palm Beach County bears each time he visits Mar-a-Lago and whether it will get paid back again. And we'll ask whether the Circle of Brotherhood's important anti-crime and violence community work will continue here. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. South Florida has one of the highest rates of HIV/AIDS infection of any region in the country. Palm Beach, Broward, and Miami-Dade all rank in the top 5% of U.S. counties for transmission of HIV, a virus that attacks the immune system. Three of our largest cities, Fort Lauderdale, Miami, and West Palm Beach, have some of the highest rates of new infections. Places like Wilton Manors, Overtown, and Doral are also trouble spots. South Florida's Black and Hispanic populations are especially at risk. And yet, at this critical moment for HIV research, detection, prevention, and response here, funding is on the chopping block as the Trump administration makes deep cuts in federal grants or terminates them altogether. This year, Florida's largest universities have already lost $30 million for HIV efforts, and the state's Department of Health has eliminated positions that include the director for patient care at the HIV/AIDS Drug Assistance Program. As a result, doctors fear we could soon see even more cases. We'd like to hear your thoughts on this significant loss of HIV funding, real and potential. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is a South Florida expert on this crisis, Dr. Elizabeth Sherman. She's a pharmacy professor at Nova Southeastern University in Davie and is on the board of the HIV Medicine Association based in Arlington, Virginia. Dr. Sherman, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
To start, can you help us better understand the HIV/AIDS situation in South Florida? It looks like just under half of the 128,000 people living with HIV in Florida live in South Florida. But when we say this region has one of the country's highest HIV infection rates, and in particular one of the highest rates of new infections, what are the data that you and your colleagues want us to be most aware of?
Everything you've said so far is true. Dade and Broward counties are HIV hotspots in the United States. In Dade County, one out of every 82 adults is known to have HIV, and in Broward, one out of every 97 adults is known to have HIV. And in Dade and Broward counties, we see between 800 to 1,000 new HIV infections every single year. We have made significant progress over the past few decades in limiting the spread of this epidemic, but if cuts are coming and cuts continue, that will start slipping away.
And before we continue, perhaps we should remind our listeners exactly what HIV is and the often fatal illness known as AIDS that it can result in and how it's transmitted.
HIV is a virus that attacks our immune system and severely weakens a person's immune system. If you treat someone's HIV as soon as they're diagnosed with HIV, then they're able to lead long, normal, productive, healthy lives. The longer you wait to treat someone's HIV infection, the more destroyed their immune system becomes, and they become increasingly sick and hospitalized with opportunistic infections and malignancies.
And the AIDS, the illness that it can result in, as I mentioned, still has no cure, correct?
That's correct. There is no cure for HIV, but researchers are working on that right now.
Right. And transmission by blood-to-blood contact, et cetera, can you help us understand exactly, you know, the transmission situation?
HIV is transmitted by contact with infected body fluids. The most common methods of transmission are through sex, heterosexual sex, men who have sex with men, and through injection drug use.
Right. So why is South Florida seeing this particularly high infection rate? As I mentioned earlier, Palm Beach, Broward, Miami-Dade counties rank in the top 5% in the U.S. for HIV transmission. What are the factors at play here that experts like yourself are taking notice of?
Well, HIV affects the entire population, but one of the things that makes South Florida stand out is we are an area of this country that's based on tourism. We have a lot of people coming in, coming out. We have a very fluid community, a lot of people coming internationally here. And when HIV spreads here and when it gets worse here, it doesn't just stay here. We see these epidemics sprout up here and then transmit across
Right,
communities.
so population transience can be a big factor then in that regard. As I also mentioned, researchers say our large Black and Hispanic communities are of particular concern, and a lot of that seems to do with the challenges of messaging, especially among Hispanics.
Yeah, we're not very, we haven't been extremely successful in getting the message out about HIV prevention and HIV treatment. Although the state of Florida has made significant strides in the most recent years with a campaign called Ending the HIV Epidemic. But we have a lot of rural populations, people that don't have access to healthcare and healthcare providers, a lot of harder to reach populations.
When I was a young reporter in Chicago, for example, in the 1980s, when this epidemic first broke out in this country, I remember that it was very difficult for public health experts and workers to reach the Hispanic community in terms of messaging, in terms of how to detect the virus and how to prevent it. What strides have been made and what still needs to be done in order to better reach the Hispanic community via language, via Spanish, for example.
Well, to be honest, one of the ways that we reach these hard to these vulnerable communities is through research, through fully funded research programs that specifically target these populations.
Right. Well, that brings us then to the issue of funding the kind of work that could be impacted by these federal cuts to HIV transmission, detection, and prevention, especially here in Florida. Dr. Sherman, what are the specific federal funding cuts that worry you and organizations like the HIV Medicine Association the most right now?
Yeah, I think it's important to start that, what do we mean by HIV research? And I think that when people think of research, they imagine a person in a white coat in a laboratory with some bubbling beakers. And when it comes to HIV, yes, we have that, but we also have real-world applications that people need to be aware of too, and why that's so important. So what is HIV research? It's developing the next line of drugs because HIV itself is evolving, and we need to be ready to treat the next evolution of it. It's studying how HIV spreads from person to person within communities. And probably most importantly, it's investigating how do we get people into care? How do we retain them in care? Because we could have the best medicines in the world, but if people aren't being tested, if they're not getting into care, if they're not staying into care, that's irrelevant. And
Right.
where does, resistant HIV come from? It comes from people who start care, who fall out of it. That's how resistant virus evolves. That's how it spreads. That's how we get new variants that are resistant to drugs. But we have the opportunity to limit that. We have the opportunity to prevent this virus from being an epidemic, and that all begins with
Well,
research.
given all that, then, what are the federal funding cuts then that you're seeing out there now that are most worrisome?
Right. So we've seen NIH research that has been cut that
And
looks
NIH being the National Institutes of Health.
Yes, exactly. The NIH is the primary federal agency that funds HIV research in this country. And so they've cut many research programs that look at older populations, you know, people who aren't aware of advances that we've made in HIV treatment. Research is how we reach them. Programs and research projects that look at women, including pregnant women, you know, where we have the opportunity to treat their HIV so that they don't pass it on to their child.
Exactly.
And like I mentioned before, rural populations, people who don't have the same access to healthcare providers that we have in big cities. Most importantly, we've seen a significant cut in CDC's HIV prevention programs and research looking at HIV prevention.
Right. Now, you remarked recently that the Florida Department of Health staffing cuts on HIV work seem most to involve the folks assigned to that very important upfront work of HIV transmission surveillance. You told the South Florida Sun Sentinel, for example, recently, quote, "When they cut people who oversee surveillance, it hampers our ability to limit transmission before it starts to spread." Can you elaborate on that point?
Right. So you have to prioritize the populations where you see HIV popping up the most. And then you take the research and the surveillance that you have on those populations and you can apply it to more general populations. So if you don't know where these epidemics are sprouting up within our communities, then you can't implement the interventions that are needed to prevent HIV spread from person to person.
Yeah, Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say we've been fine-tuning HIV prevention for decades. We have very effective prevention methods. We have pre-exposure prophylaxis, PrEP. It works. We know that people who take PrEP don't get HIV, but we don't know who to deliver PrEP to if we don't have the epidemiologic surveillance
right.
that's needed.
And I do want to get to that question of PrEP in just a second, but at that more on-the-ground level you were just talking about, tell us, for example, about efforts like the mobile units that traverse our communities here in South Florida. I believe the University of Miami conducts one such effort called Connect that serve as direct intervention when it comes to HIV transmission detection and prevention. How important are projects like that, and how badly do they stand to be affected by these federal cuts?
These types of projects are already being affected. We have a high-impact HIV prevention program in the state of Florida, and recently, within the past few weeks, it was announced that this prevention program, which was funded by a CDC grant, has been eliminated. What this means is that the state of Florida will no longer be receiving rapid HIV test kits.
Okay.
So this program funded those rapid tests that were being administered on mobile vans, at community outreach settings, at health fairs. Now, as of June 30th, state of Florida will no longer receive these rapid HIV tests. That means you can't get an HIV test unless you have a primary care provider and you're able to go to them and pay for an HIV test.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Sherman of the Nova Southeastern University and the HIV Medicine Association about the serious funding cuts facing South Florida's work to stem its HIV/AIDS infection crisis. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Dr. Sherman, I'd like to pivot just a little here to the question that you sort of touched on earlier, the question of how these federal HIV funding cuts will impact not just the detection and surveillance of transmission, but also prevention, research into the HIV/AIDS virus itself and the medicines that fight it. There is still no cure for HIV and AIDS, as we mentioned, but how badly is this going to set the research effort back?
If you slow down the pipeline of scientific discovery, now you have delays in developing better HIV medicines. You slow down the development of new ways to prevent HIV, like long-acting injectables or neutralizing antibodies, and you do hinder that pursuit of a cure for HIV. You can't forget that HIV evolves like the common cold. We need tomorrow's medicines tomorrow. Not next year, not during the next administration, because HIV is evolving as we speak.
Evolving like the COVID virus, for example.
Exactly right.
Okay. Now, as you mentioned before, Florida is one of six states that has been receiving federal funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, for HIV prevention medicines, like one, as you mentioned before, called pre-exposure prophylactics, or PrEP for short. Is that threatened now as well?
Yes, the CDC's Office of HIV Prevention is facing serious cuts in the next fiscal year, 2026.
Now, as a pharmacologist, what are the most promising HIV/AIDS drugs being developed out there that you see? In recent decades, I think most lay people like myself have become familiar with the so-called, quote, cocktails of drugs that have proven very effective. Where do things stand today in that regard, and what's on the horizon?
Cocktails of drugs are still required. You still require multiple medications from different drug classes. What has changed is, and what is changing is, number one, new formulations. So the ability to, like I said before, long acting medications that don't require daily medication adherence, maybe an injection you get every 6 months, that kind of thing. And then also we need new medications from new novel drug classes that are effective against resistant virus. And so those are the two burgeoning areas of HIV treatment research.
Mm-hmm. What about the HIV patients themselves? Do they fear that these federal funding cuts in HIV research and prevention mean a less hopeful future for them? And could that possibly make them less motivated, let's say, to participate in the work researchers do?
Yes, absolutely. I have patients who are covered by Medicaid, covered by the Ryan White program, covered by these safety net programs, who are worried sick about what's going to happen if these cuts come through. You know, these are not easy treatments for people to access care. It is not the easiest path. So putting any more administrative burdens on them is going to be harmful to the progress that we've made in slowing the epidemic in this country and in South Florida.
And you mentioned Ryan White. That, again, takes me back to the 1980s when I was a reporter covering that drama. The young man, teenager who got AIDS through a blood transfusion, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Exactly right.
Now, finally, Dr. Sherman, as you know, the immigration issue seems to leach into every conversation we have these days. So we also wanted to ask you if you see a risk that because of this federal pullback on HIV work, foreign-born and non-citizen patients will now be reluctant to, say, pick up prescriptions for fear of being deported?
Yes, we're seeing that every day. Patients are afraid to come to clinic. They're afraid to go to the pharmacy to pick up their medications. They're afraid to go to the labs to get their labs done so we can monitor that these medications are effective. Absolutely, harmful immigration policies, threatening immigration policies deter patients from care. They deter them from these touch points in the healthcare system.
Well, then finally, do you get the sense with all these problems we've been discussing that the Trump administration perhaps is going to soften these cuts because of the public response to this?
You know, the Congress is in the appropriations process right now, and I'm not a politician. I'm a clinician. I'm a professor. You know, my priority is people with HIV and making sure that they get the treatment that they need, the right treatment at the right time when they need it.
Okay. Dr. Elizabeth Sherman is a pharmacy professor at Nova Southeastern University and a board member of the HIV Medicine Association. Dr. Sherman, many thanks.
Thank you.
Still to come, will Palm Beach County get paid back for protecting President Trump? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. $240,000 a day. That's what it costs Palm Beach County to provide security for President Trump whenever he's at his Mar-a-Lago resort, also known as the Florida White House. It's considered especially important given that two assassination attempts against Trump during his campaign occurred last year. In Trump's first presidency, Congress made sure Palm Beach County got reimbursed for that expense. The question is whether Congress will pay Palm Beach County back this time around. It's not unusual for local governments to pony up for security when presidents visit home, whether it was George W. Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas, or Joe Biden's lakefront digs in Delaware. But $250,000 a day? And that Palm Beach price tag is under more scrutiny this week, given questions about President Trump's controversial taste for luxury, like the 747 jumbo jet he wants to accept from Qatar's royal family, which now has his opponents calling Mar-a-Lago Qatar-a-Lago. What are your thoughts about local governments bearing the presidential security costs? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Victoria DeCardenas, a reporter for CBS 12 News in West Palm Beach, who's been doing great reporting on this story. Victoria, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's discuss right up front just how much money Palm Beach County has had to set aside for its role in protecting President Trump whenever he comes to Mar-a-Lago. We're hearing figures like $45 million for this fiscal year. How is the county paying for this?
Yeah, that's right. $45 million. And that money is coming from the Palm Beach County Contingency Reserve, which is, you know, in its name, it's made for unforeseen circumstances. So that's how they've been paying it so far.
Okay. How many visits has President Trump made to Mar-a-Lago since his second inauguration in January? And how many more do they estimate he'll make this year?
So far, he's made at least 10. I'm seeing numbers of 11. He's come here quite a bit since his second term.
Well, excuse me, 10 visits since January?
Yes, and I did some number crunching. Maybe math is not my specialty, but that's anywhere up to like $3 million a day.
Is the White House that lousy a place to spend the weekends?
You know, I think that would be up to the president if he feels that way.
I mean, especially this time of year, you got the cherry blossoms. It'd be a very pleasant place to hang out for the weekend. So 10 so far, and I'm sorry, I interrupted you there. You were making the point about how many he could be making for the entire year.
Yeah, we expect him to come back quite a bit. The Palm Beach County Sheriff, Rick Bradshaw, he says he expects to see Trump maybe even more here at Mar-a-Lago than he does at the White House.
Okay. Well, then again, Washington probably doesn't have that great a set of golf courses, so I guess I could see the point from that vantage. But now, as we mentioned, Victoria, this comes to an estimated $240,000 a day for each presidential visit to Palm Beach County. What specifically do we know that money pays for in terms of what the county contributes to the president's security?
Yeah, so obviously $240,000 a day is a huge, huge number. But what we know, according to Palm Beach County Sheriff Rick Bradshaw, is that money that he has asked from the county is only paying for overtime of his deputies in helping protect the president. But that also, you know, goes to the county, the city, and the town of Palm Beach, where Mar-a-Lago is located. That helps them shut down the roads and also put up the signage to say, hey, you know, you can't come to Palm Beach, the town of Palm Beach, because the president is in town. So it encompasses a lot of things, but that money mainly and only is, rather, for overtime in the Palm Beach County deputies.
That's interesting. So it doesn't cover things, you know, like gasoline for patrol cars to get out and block off roads and you know, nitty-gritty items like that then.
Right. All the things you don't think of, you know, the gas in the boats around Mar-a-Lago, the gas in all the cars parked outside of Mar-a-Lago. Yeah. That doesn't count for that. It's just in overtime. And, you know, that means time and a half for some of these deputies.
Right. And Palm Beach County Sheriff Rick Bradshaw, as you mentioned, recently reminded folks about how this works. Let's take a listen to what he said.
It's expensive, but we don't really have a choice. We cannot let something bad happen for the third time. But the request that we have is from the Secret Service. We don't go over there and say, we think we need to be here or there. They request it, and then we provide it.
So the president's Secret Service detail then lays out for the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office what it needs to provide, again, to the tune of about $240,000 a day. And that makes sense, I guess. But Victoria, let's talk about that other point Sheriff Bradshaw made in his remarks. Quote, "We can't afford to let this happen a third time." Sheriff Bradshaw was, of course, referring to those two assassination attempts President Trump faced last year, one of them actually in Palm Beach County on a golf course. How large a specter has that cast over the question of security for President Trump when he's back home up there?
Well, you heard the sheriff. He doesn't want a third assassination attempt to happen, especially not on his watch again. For viewers or listeners, I should say, I'm used to TV. Where the president was almost assassinated, his golf course backs up to the sheriff's office. So it really hit close to home to the sheriff. You know, he's been protecting him for quite a number of years, right? And he takes protecting the president very seriously. So,
right. And we should point out, Victoria, I mean, he took special pride in the fact that it was his people to a large extent who found that guy who allegedly was waiting in the bushes to shoot President Trump on the golf course last year, right?
Absolutely. He's very proud of his team and what they've done, and he considers it a great honor. So like he said, you know, he doesn't want to spare any expense, especially after given the second assassination attempt was literally in their backyard.
But how much more expensive do you think that has made his security requirements, meaning Trump's security requirements in Palm Beach County during his second presidency than they were during his first presidency?
Yeah, so I did some digging on this because I wasn't here in Palm Beach County for his first presidency. And we had some news outlets reporting that it has cost within July of 2024 to November 2024, it cost $13 million in overtime. So that was about 100,000 hours of overtime, some of the reports that I'm seeing. And that was just $4 million less than what it cost to protect him in his entire first
presidency. Wow.
So
okay.
If that gives you any sort of perspective of how serious and how expensive it is to have the president in town, I mean, those numbers are mind-boggling.
No, that's great reporting, Victoria. However, is that $250,000 a day cost considered reasonable or exorbitant? For example, I myself went back and checked out on what Chicago paid for former President Obama's security whenever he spent time at his South Side home there. And suffice it to say, it did not rise to $45 million. Do we know if there are factors that might make protecting President Trump more expensive than usual? Mar-a-Lago itself, for example, its proximity to the ocean, you know, requiring maritime as well as ground and air surveillance, or even his proclivity for being out in the open on the golf courses there. Does all this play into that more exorbitant cost?
Oh, absolutely. I've been covering the president now for the two and a half years that I've been here in Palm Beach County. And I don't know how much people realize where Mar-a-Lago sits. It's on Palm Beach Island. So they've got water on both ends. There's boats near Mar-a-Lago. He lives by a roundabout. So there are tons of law enforcement and Secret Service agents who are there protecting that area. And also, you know, we talk about Mar-a-Lago being the Southern White House, right? But that's also a clubhouse. So there are people there going there every day to enjoy the amenities that Mar-a-Lago has to offer.
Right.
So it is a really big operation.
I can only imagine
that it's going to get even bigger, you know,
right,
throughout his presidency.
Very complicated security-wise, yeah. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Victoria DeCardenas of CBS 12 News in West Palm Beach about the $250,000 a day in security costs Palm Beach County pays for President Trump's visits to Mar-a-Lago. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. So, Victoria, let's then look at the question of reimbursement. As we mentioned, local governments are historically paid back for these millions they pay out for a president's security, but not completely. I mentioned Chicago vis-a-vis Obama before. It did not appear to get a 100% reimbursement. So We know Congress made sure Palm Beach County got reimbursed for what it ponied up during Trump's first presidency. Do we know if they got it all back? And just as important, does Palm Beach County know for sure that the current Congress will reimburse them for Trump's second presidency?
Yeah, so let me answer your first question. County commissioners said that they were paid back during Trump's first presidency. It was a lot simpler than, you know, but will they be reimbursed now? That sort of remains unclear. That is according to county commissioners I've spoken to. So here's why. The bump in security after the assassination attempts may be covered by Congress because, you know, he was not president at the time. He was running, and we know that former presidents and sometimes presidential candidates do get granted Secret Service and extra protections. County officials tell me, though, that they have already reached out to Congress to see if they can get reimbursed soon. So we're just going to wait to hear back, and that may take a while. We may not see that until next year.
Yeah, first Congress has to get this budget battle worked out right now.
Right.
In one of your reports, a Palm Beach County commissioner mentions to you that it was a, quote, challenge for the county to assume the cost of President Trump's security before he became president, again, when he was campaigning last year and during the few months when he was president-elect. Did Palm Beach County not get reimbursed for the security costs it bore then during that period?
Well, that's what I think.
It was Commissioner Weiss, I think, that you were.
Yes, that's who I spoke to. They were reimbursed, like I mentioned, for his first presidency. But that's what they're trying to figure out now is, are they going to get reimbursed before he was president? Because they had to bump up his security to presidential status, which before he did not have.
Yeah.
They got it at the highest level. So that's kind of what we're waiting on to see if Congress will respond to that.
Now, I also wanted to ask if there's a sense up there in Palm Beach County that the whole Mar-a-Lago luxury mystique heightens the need for more presidential security. What I'm getting at is that President Trump didn't exactly play down that reputation that Mar-a-Lago has this week when he said he wanted to accept a luxury 747 jumbo jet that the royal family of Qatar is offering him as a gift for his new presidential Air Force One, and then, I guess, his private use after his presidency, or at least the use of his presidential library. In fact, you've probably covered the Democrats and other Trump opponents up there this week sporting signs calling Mar-a-Lago Qatar-a-Lago now. How do most folks in Palm Beach County feel about that, more esoteric aspect of all this and how it plays into the security costs?
Well, you know, I feel like that's an interesting question because I feel like people are trying to wrap their heads around this whole 747 that might be gifted to him.
Yeah, and that might be parked there, you know, for the rest of his presidency every weekend. Yeah.
Right, right. And I think many people are just really wondering the legalities. At least that's what's happening in my newsroom. You know, how can the president receive this sort of gift from a foreign nation and then use it as Air Force One as he, you know, intends to use it? But I think it'll be interesting to see how that plays all out. You know, I think people are kind of shocked and trying to digest this information. But it's pretty interesting if we do see that 747 parked at Palm Beach International Airport.
But is there a feeling amongst just, you know, the hoi polloi like you and me that in Palm Beach County that perhaps this president's penchant, let's say, for more luxurious living and all of how all of that surrounds Mar-a-Lago tends to maybe raise the price, let's say, of security for him as opposed to other presidents in the past?
It might. I think people are starting to scratch their heads a little bit, but we all know that Donald Trump, President Trump, has always had a little flair to him. He likes the gaudy, the loud, the gold, if you will.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if people are so worried about how much it would cost, you know, having this new plane in terms of security. I think it'll just be another way for people to come on over and see what the president is up to here
right.
in Palm Beach County.
And finally, along those lines, Victoria, you did mention in one of your reports that Palm Beach County residents do seem to feel President Trump's visits cause a lot of traffic headaches up there. And so maybe they wish perhaps he'd make a few less visits back to Florida?
Yeah, I mean, it is definitely a mixed bag of opinions for people that I have asked out in the street. We get a lot of tourists here. Some people love that they live in the same city or county as the president. I mean, how many people can say that? It is,
Sure, yeah.
pretty cool at the face of it. But those who live on Palm Beach Island, specifically his neighbors or people who like to go to the beach there, they don't love it as much. It is a huge traffic nightmare every time the president is in town because they shut down one of their our main roads, Southern Boulevard,
Yeah.
and then anywhere near Mar-a-Lago and along A1A, where everyone likes to get the scenic views that we have here in South Florida, that is rerouted and it's shut down, and only people who live there can go there. So it does become a little annoying for the people who live here and whenever the president is in town, especially if it's during rush hour. So it is a bag. It depends on who you ask, but definitely 50-50 for that.
It's the price you pay for that kind of presidential cachet. Yeah. So,
Yeah, exactly.
Victoria De Cardenas is a reporter for CBS 12 News in West Palm Beach. Victoria, many thanks.
Thank you.
Still to come, can the Circle of Brotherhood and grassroots crime and violence prevention in South Florida survive Trump administration funding cuts? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Paget. 12 years ago, an innovative community nonprofit was launched in Miami's Brownsville neighborhood called the Circle of Brotherhood. Its mission was to help prevent crime and violence in South Florida's neighborhoods by promoting the kind of social and economic opportunities that steer people, especially young people, away from crime and violence. Like any organization, it's seen some controversy. Earlier this year, its Miami-Dade County funding was temporarily frozen over rules compliance issues. But Circle of Brotherhood's intervention and community wellness programs are widely applauded, which is why the sudden elimination of its federal funding now has many community members crying foul. In recent days, the Trump administration informed the group that hundreds of thousands of dollars in grant money that it expected this year won't be coming. What are your thoughts on the community effect this will have? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio here is the Circle of Brotherhood's Executive Director, Brother Lyle Muhammad. Brother Lyle, thanks very much for coming in.
Well, we thank you, Tim, and to your listening audience. We always wish good greetings to you all.
Thank you. Before we get into the financial challenges I just mentioned, take us back to 2013 when Circle of Brotherhood was founded. What brought it about and what was its core mission and vision?
That's a great question because it really all evolved very organically. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, a lot of people are familiar with the show called First 48, mm-hmm. That crime detective murder solving
right.
show. Well, at the time, there was a young man named Detective Ford, who now I think retired from Miami Beach as a deputy chief, mm-hmm. North Miami Beach, that is. But let alone he was on that show doing homicide investigation for 27 years. Some rash murders were taking place. And he sought help from a local commissioner at that time in District 5, Commissioner Michelle Spence Jones. Mm-hmm. And they said, look, well, we don't know what to do, but we know who to call. So about five or six of us were called together, many meeting for the first time. And after we heard then Detective Ford's presentation, we made a promise to ourselves that we would never allow things that would cause differences to get in the way of what we could do together. And that gave genesis to the birth of the Circle of Brotherhood.
As sort of a complement to police work in the communities, on the streets?
Well, it actually evolved into that. Mm-hmm. Many of us have a variety of different background in community service, including crime, violence, intervention, and prevention. Mm-hmm. While we have awesome working relationships with both the City of Miami and Miami-Dade Police Department, there's a segment of crime prevention intervention that is solely the duty and responsibility of the community and trained community members, particularly when you're talking about gun violence in this day and age.
Right. Now, in those past 12 years, what would you identify as the Circle of Brotherhood's most important accomplishments, both in terms of developing social and economic opportunities for folks in our communities and how that has helped reduce instances of crime and violence in those communities? I know you've mentioned that your target neighborhoods, for example, have seen an 80% drop in violent crime.
Right. You know, and as astonishing as that may sound, And that research report will be finalized in a few days, actually. That's done by a national firm. But it also just bears witness to the fact that if you look at the zip codes that we have, let's say, 100% of our services in, mm-hmm. and you look at the magnitude, and those, that data actually comes from the coroner's office and the medical examiner. So it's it's not police data. It's not political data.
Okay.
It comes straight from that source.
But walk us through, Brother Lyle, a little how the Circle of Brotherhood's work plays out. How does your organization intervene in the community to meet those goals that you set?
So if I take you all the way back to 2018, was the first time we had a chance to present our comprehensive community wellness and violence intervention program before the county and the city. And we have not moved off of that to the point where it's actually become a national model. But it's a holistic approach. We've always said that, number one, that gun violence is a public health epidemic.
Right.
And we've always said that there are credible messengers who have to be trained, who live in communities that are plagued by gun violence, who know how to not only become conflict mediators, but bring the type of services that decrease the things that lead to violence.
Mm-hmm. So 2 years ago, Circle of Brotherhood received a $2 million federal grant from the Justice Department, correct? For your work and for your staffing. Yours was one of some 365 Justice Department grants for community crime prevention programs across the country. Circle of Brotherhood was anticipating a final $600,000 installment of that grant for this year, and then just a few weeks ago you were informed it won't be coming. Why do you think the Trump administration cut that funding off?
Well, according to the document, and that's all that I have to go by.
Sure.
Because we haven't been visited by anyone from the administration.
Right.
Our work has not been vetted by anyone from the administration. The termination, and it's the same letter that went to the other 364 organizations and said it's no longer a priority of this administration's direction. So for us, look, the critical thing about it, to be quite honest, Tim, is if you look at the timing, everyone knows that violence, particularly gun violence, it peaks across our country just before summer
and during the summer. Yeah.
You know, and so I think that itself is a death wish, but I think it's also a great opportunity for us to really appeal to people who really say they support this work and not support it with a proclamation, but support it with a check, whether it's private citizens. But I think the biggest thing is people will be amazed at the role that our organization and similar organizations have literally played in driving down crime across the entire county.
Where then does that leave you? Because I know you've also announced recently that Circle of Brotherhood is facing a budget deficit now of about $1.5 million.
It's not necessarily a budget deficit, but with the recent cut, and then we also have other federal grants that could be in jeopardy as well. That we've been playing dodgeball with, if you will, pun intended. But it's an earmark. Mm-hmm. I know, for example, it's going to take us about $1.6 million to keep our staff for a year. And so that is a fundraising benchmark. We lost $608,000 from the DOJ grant. All of our program is in jeopardy because it's all intertwined.
How did the organization come to face that kind of budget shortfall?
Well, we didn't face a shortfall. Uh-huh. We received the termination letter on April 27th.
I mean, aside from the $600,000 grant money that you've lost, have there been funding challenges on top of that as well?
It's safe to say that we have never since our existence had a proper budget to fully implement our community wellness and violence intervention program. We've always done the best we could with what we have.
Yeah.
And this is the closest that we have been to building sustainable gun violence intervention from one end of the county to another.
Well, as I mentioned, Circle of Brotherhood also had a bit of a tussle earlier this year with Miami-Dade County, specifically County Commissioner Keon Hardiman, regarding questions surrounding your use of county funding for things like community housing assistance. But you and Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava have resolved that issue, correct? But is that county funding enough to keep Circle of Brotherhood operating adequately while you try to figure out the other, you know, budget issues?
So a couple of things need to be made clear. Number one, based upon how myself and my employees and members were treated at that January, I believe it was around the 22nd or the 25th meeting, we have sent an inquiry into all commissioners, into the mayor's office, and also to the attorney's office with about 7 inquiries, and we haven't had a response back yet. Those inquiries were not only emailed and also to the chief of staffs, but they were also hand-delivered to those offices.
But the county's funding has been restored to you.
So, again, I think there's some smoke and mirrors there.
Okay.
The only program that the Circle of Brotherhood has that is funded by the county in terms of gun violence prevention or anything is a contract that's been in place since 2018.
Okay.
And so none of our community violence intervention and wellness programs are funded by the county.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Brother Lyle Muhammad, director of the grassroots crime and violence prevention organization, the Circle of Brotherhood, about its survival after losing its federal funding. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Now, as we mentioned earlier, Circle of Brotherhood was one of hundreds of community crime prevention nonprofits around the country to have their federal Justice Department funding abruptly cut off in the past few weeks. So in the bigger picture, Brother Lyle, what impact do you think that is going to have on communities like Miami's and South Florida's when you consider that one of the key things that makes groups like yours matter is that police can't be everywhere all the time?
And not only that, this is really not a policing matter and issue. Mm-hmm. When you talk about the effect, first of all, the economy, there are organizations, and we're plugged into the national network of CVI programs across this country who had to lay off as many as 80% of their staff. So you're literally talking about not only an issue dealing with people who deal directly with gun violence intervention and prevention, but their families and their economies being affected across 23 different cities. Right. So you're also looking at a spike in that. You're also looking at, when you talk about the credible messengers that do everything from safe passages to school programs to counseling and mental health and abuse and wellness services abruptly being terminated at a very trying time in America. Mm-hmm. It's a very dangerous time.
Right. And when you look at a city like Chicago, for example, it has these issues, you know, to a great extent, you know, on the south side and the west side, right, where I used to be a reporter, for example. The loss of funding for those kinds of efforts, what kind of effect will that have?
Well, let's just be clear. I give this example. If we can flash back a quick second to COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And when we looked at COVID and we looked at the value of nurses and doctors during COVID, I haven't met a family yet that hasn't had a loss of life or suffered some type of defeat from our COVID epidemic. Can you imagine if doctors and nurses were terminated and laid off during a COVID pandemic? And so, look, family, let's just be clear. It's clear across the country that programs like ours are having a significant impact in unprecedented numbers at decreasing not only gun violence, but decreasing the type of situations that lead up to gun violence.
Right, exactly. In what ways, then, is Circle of Brotherhood hoping to make up for both this loss of federal funding and its budget deficit? I see on your website that a fundraising drive has been launched. How can people contribute?
You know, that's a beautiful question. If I had a hat on right now, I would take it off to my staff. I don't know where you would find the type of dedicated individuals.
And speaking of your staff, how many people are we talking about, you know, whose jobs could be at risk?
30 individuals.
Okay.
30 individuals that do everything from direct street crime intervention to credible messengers to youth success coaches to wellness coaches to reentry across the gamut. But I take my hat off to them because they're actually participating in raising funds for our fundraiser. So I don't know where you go when you find employees that have the type of heart and the work they do to raise their own salaries, but we have a holistic approach, not just a grassroots approach, but we're calling on those who we have relationships with, whether they be foundations or private individuals that we work with in the community. Mm-hmm. Again, we're appealing to those who know that what we're doing is valuable and to support it.
And the goal is $1.5 million?
The goal is 1.6. And the reason why it's that goal, because we can keep our staff for a year without having to worry about laying off a soul, giving us a footing in both sustainability and the crime prevention, but also sustainability as an organization moving forward.
In just the 15 seconds we have left, What is law enforcement saying about these cuts to organizations like yours?
Well, I can't tell you what they're saying across the country, but I can tell you both. Chief Morales has a great deal of respect for the work of the Circle of Brotherhood, as do we. And also our deputy, our sheriff, Rosie, as well. We have good working relationships with the police here.
Brother Lyle Muhammad is executive director of the Circle of Brotherhood. Brother Lyle, many thanks and best of luck.
We thank you for having us, Tim.
Finally on the roundup, last month, Miami-Dade County confirmed it would demolish a portion of one of Miami's iconic landmarks, the Coconut Grove Playhouse. The plan includes replacing it with a smaller, more modern theater and outdoor commercial space. But a group of nearby residents, calling themselves Preserve the West Grove, are pushing back. They formed a couple of years ago to confront what they call the harmful gentrification of the surrounding community, including Little Bahamas.
That's my biggest concern, losing the community, because we're just like one big family.
Shirley Gibson was raised on Charles Avenue in the West Grove. Her great-grandmother emigrated to the area from the Bahamas in 1879.
I think about the younger generation. We want to leave a legacy, a heritage for them. But will it be here for them? I don't know.
That's something for Miami-Dade County officials to consider. They say the Coconut Grove Playhouse will be fully redeveloped by 2027. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateus Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.